There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, turning away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions also were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and very many servants. And that man was the greatest of all the men of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of feasting had completed their cycle, Job would send and consecrate them, rising up early in the morning and offering burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "Perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where do you come?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him." So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord. Now on the day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans attacked and took them. They also slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 bands and made a raid on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another also came and said, "Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell on the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." So the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speak. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" And all this Job did not sin with his lips. Now when Job's 3 friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, and they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and confront him. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept, and each one of them tore his robe and threw dust up over his head toward the sky. And then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights, with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. Perhaps you are sitting there thinking to yourself, Brian, why do we have to look at the book of Job here in the dead of winter, at the beginning of a new year when we just need some encouragement? Couldn't we look at something shorter, something more lighthearted, encouraging, like maybe the book of Philippians or something like that? When our adult education class began looking at the book of Job back in September, I will admit to you that I wasn't sure I wanted to spend much time in this book. And the reason is that I have learned that the Lord will not allow His word to be preached and taught except that the preacher or the teacher does a certain amount of applying first. Job's life was pretty good when he starts out this book. My life is pretty good too, and all things being equal, I would like to keep my health and my family and my house, even my job. And yet, as we traveled through this book together, I and all those who travel in our group, we came to see that even if our worst fears were to come to rest, we would be in the hands of a good and loving God. The book of Job is an encouraging book, and it teaches us something about God that we must carry into the new year with us. The thought that's going to tie these three messages together is simply this. The way we think about God when afflicted is the way we truly think about God. The way we think about God determines the way we think about everything else. Our subject is thinking about God in affliction, thinking with Job about God in affliction. We're going to talk today about the presence of affliction. Next week we'll talk about the purpose of affliction. And then in 2 weeks we're going to talk about God's plan for affliction. The big idea for today, the idea that we don't want to walk out of here without, is this. My thoughts about God will be tested and revealed by affliction. My thoughts about God will be tested and revealed by affliction, just as Job's was. I like to think of the book of Job as a musical, like one of the classic musicals, maybe Sound of Music or Fiddler on the Roof, something like that. Think about how those musicals work. There are certain scenes that give you the setting, the narrative scenes. They tell you where the story takes place and when in history and who the characters are, that kind of thing. And then there's also lyrical scenes, songs. These are the scenes when, you know, the orchestra starts and somebody just starts singing. And if you're watching the musical with your family, the men get up and they go to the kitchen. And after a while, the song ends and the men come back. There are dialogue scenes where people are talking, and through the course of their conversation, the argument or the storyline is developed. We have all of that in Job, even in this section that we're going to look at today. We're going to look at chapters 1 through 27 today. Don't worry, we're not going to read all of it. This section includes narrative. We've just read the narrative part, the story. It includes songs, maybe not with music, but at least lyrics, poetry. And it includes dialogue, people speaking together, revealing in this case their thinking about God. In this first section, we learn that the thinking about God that results when Job is afflicted results in, number one, Job's friend's assertion that God, who rewards righteousness and punishes wickedness, is punishing Job for some secret sin. That's what they're going to tell him. And two, Job's claim that God, who afflicts him, though he is innocent, is arbitrary and absent in his suffering. These are the two ideas that are going to be pitted against each other. We have two main points as we go through this. The first is affliction tests our thinking about God. And we see this in chapters 1 through 3. And here Job, the exemplary worshiper of God, whose devotion formerly resulting in blessing but now resulting in affliction, must consider his estimation of God and his motivation for serving God. We get a short introduction to Job in the first five verses of the book. He is righteous. We don't mean here that he's impeccable like Christ. Job sinned. But there are no sins that God holds against him. He has confessed all his sins. He is in right relationship with God. Not only that, but he has a ministry of intercession for other people. He offers sacrifices for the sins of others. He's a kind of priest. He is also blessed by God, having received all the blessings that you could imagine that a person who is blessed by God could possibly receive. The greatest man of the East. The rest of chapters 1 and 2 that we read together are made up of heaven and earth scenes. There are two of them. These two scenes start off in heaven, where we see God and the angelic hosts. Job doesn't see them, but we see them. And then each of these scenes ends on the earth, where we see the result of what takes place up in heaven. This happens twice. We start off in heaven, where Satan presents himself before God. We don't know if this is a special presentation or if Satan always does this because he is an angel, though fallen. And Job is minding his business. Don't lose sight of that. Job is serving God, minding his business. God calls Satan's attention to Job, and he says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Satan answers the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side?" Verse 9, chapter 1. What Satan is saying is that Job only serves you because you bless him. Are you, God, really worthy of Job's trust? Are you enough for him? There's a very subtle idea that is important in the book of Job. We find it just under the surface here. And it shows us that the main person in the book of Job is not really Job, it's God. What Satan is asking is, God, are you worthy of the worship and adoration of your image bearers who are made in your image and likeness? Or do they just serve you because you give them good stuff? That's the question. And to find out the answer, God grants Satan permission to touch Job's family and possessions. We come down to earth. Job loses his children, his dwelling, his riches. Job's response, verse 21, chapter 1, the Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. The next verse, through all this Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Second heaven and earth scene, we're in chapter 2, back up in heaven. Satan appears before God again. God says to him, Job still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. Satan responds, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. Verse 4. In other words, you, God, haven't given me enough authority to make my point. We still don't know. And so God allows Satan to strike Job's body. Satan does. We're back on earth. Satan strikes Job with these terrible boils that so completely disfigured him that nobody could recognize him, made him want to die, probably was a death sentence. Now Job talks to his wife. Job's wife says, curse God and die. Very interesting here. The word curse is related to the word to bless. I think what she's saying is that God has some business with you. You've got some secret sin. You know, just bless him. Get on with it. Do whatever God wants you to do. And then die if you're going to. Job is very gentle with his wife. Did you notice that? He says, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. In other words, you're better than this. Shall we accept good from the Lord and not accept adversity? Verse 10, chapter 2, Job did not sin with his lips. And then verse 11, his friends arrive. They come, they see him. They throw dust in the air. They can't believe it. He looks terrible. They sit down. They're quiet 7 days, seven nights. It's the best thing they ever did. As soon as they start talking, they mess everything up. Chapter 3, we didn't read it, but it's one of those song sections. Job laments. It's very interesting if you read it later. He goes through each of the 6 days of creation, and he tries to decreate the day. Oh, day number 4. Oh, that it were not created. You know, he wants to die. He wants to decreate himself. Better to be non-existent. But he can't bring about his non-existence. He still exists. But he doesn't curse God. Why do you serve God? Why do I serve God? Is it because he's worthy, or is it only because we desire his good blessings? What if in 2011 you find no distinct short-term advantages to serving God? What if you don't understand what God is doing in your life? What if God's dealing in your life rocks your categories and so scrambles everything you formerly believed about God and the way that he works, that you're totally confused? Will you yet serve him? Affliction tests whether or not we desire God himself or his blessings only. Amanda and I have just celebrated our 3rd anniversary of being with you here at Faith Bible Church. We're now working on our 4th year. And you have blessed us like no group of people outside of our families. Thank you. But what if we didn't serve here? What if we served in one of those really, really difficult churches that does not bless, but that only makes miserable, apparently? You know, I read recently that the average tenure of a pastor is roughly equivalent to the average tenure of an NFL football player. So you can be injured in either line of work. I'd like to believe that by God's grace, if we were in such a church, that we would go on serving him. But you don't know until you've been so afflicted. Affliction tests our thinking about God. Second main point for today, affliction reveals our true thoughts about God. And here we come to the dialogue section. This stretches all the way from chapter 4 to chapter 27. Don't worry, we're not going to read them. We'll look at some highlights. Here we see Job, while sharing his friend's notion that God rewards the righteous while punishing the wicked, becomes embittered at God, whom he considers arbitrary, absent, and unjust in afflicting him. This section is set up in 3 cycles. Eliphaz is going to speak first. Job's going to respond. Then Bildad will talk. Then Job's going to respond. Then Zophar will talk. Job's going to respond. That's cycle 1. Same pattern is repeated in cycle 2. And then the same pattern is repeated a 3rd time in cycle 3, except that with these 2 other cycles, Job's words become more. His friends' words become less. His friends get more and more beat up. So that at the end, Zophar doesn't even talk in the 3rd cycle. They get more and more dug in as they go along. Let's look at Eliphaz, chapters 4 through 5. He is the most revered and refined of Job's three friends. He argues from his own experience, insisting that Job's affliction results from some secret sin that should be confessed. Very interesting. In several places here, we see that what Eliphaz teaches is actually Job's very own teaching. Of the four of them, Job was apparently the senior. He had taught the other three, and now they're repeating Job's teaching back to him, and he doesn't like it one bit now that he's on the other side. Eliphaz reiterates Job's theology of suffering. Verse 2, chapter 4, "If one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking? Behold, you have admonished many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you have strengthened feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed." Verse 7, chapter 4, he develops this theology of suffering. According to Eliphaz, the innocent don't suffer. "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright destroyed? Not only that, but the guilty receive judgment." Verses 8 and 9, chapter 4. Eliphaz says, "According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they come to an end." Job, you must have sinned. I don't know what you've done, but you've sinned. You need to come to God. Make it right with him. He urges Job to seek God. Chapter 5, verse 8. "But as for me, I would seek God, and I would place my cause before God." Job knows he hasn't sinned. We know he hasn't sinned. Eliphaz doesn't know that. And then in chapter 5, beginning in verse 17, Eliphaz offers a vain hope of peace. 17 and verses 23, 26, 27. These are some great lines. Eliphaz talks about what it would look like for Job to be at peace with God. He says, "Behold, how happy is the man whom God reproves, so do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. For you will be in league with the stones of the field." Isn't that great? "And the beast of the field will be at peace with you. You will come to the grave in full vigor, like the stacking of grain in its season. Behold this, we have investigated it, and so it is. Hear it and know for yourself." Well, Job accepts Eliphaz's premise that God blesses righteousness but punishes sin, but the problem is, he's innocent, and he maintains his innocence. Chapters 6 and 7, Job pleads for death while maintaining his righteousness. Verse 10, chapter 6, Job says, "But it is still my consolation, and I rejoice in unsparing pain that I have not denied the words of the Holy One." Eliphaz has failed to prove Job's guilt, so Bildad is going to try. Bildad is a naturalist. In an ancient sense, he argues from history and nature, insisting that Job should confess his secret sin and receive blessing from God in chapter 8. Here he promises blessing if Job will confess. Verse 20 of chapter 8, Bildad says, "Lo, God will not reject a man of integrity, nor will he support the evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting." In response to this, in chapters 9 and 10, Job despairs of vindicating himself to his three friends and appeals directly to God, even as he despairs of receiving a hearing before God. And Job, chapter 9, charges God with enacting chaos and with indifference. And here I think Job begins to sin. Verse 13, "God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him crouch the helpers of Rahab." Rahab, ancient Near Eastern god of chaos. "How then can I answer him and choose my words before him? For though I were right, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice, for he bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. Job, though righteous of any original sin, is revealing his theology about suffering and about God. Bildad has failed. Here comes Zophar. He's going to try. Zophar is a fundamentalist and a bully. He offers praise to God while emphasizing the futility of appealing one's righteousness to him. Speaks in chapter 11, really has nothing original to say. He suggests that God is unfathomable. Verse 7, chapter 11, can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? They are high as the heavens. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Chapters 12 through 14, Job turns his attention from his friend's counsel in order to appeal directly to God. In the end, Job really doesn't care what his friends think. He wants to hear from God. Turns his attention from his friends, chapter 13, verse 3, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God, but you smear with lies, you false friends. You are all worthless physicians. And then he addresses God, chapter 13, verse 20. Only two things do not do to me, then I will not hide my face from you. Remove your hand from me and let not the dread of you terrify me. Then call and I will answer, or let me speak, then reply to me. And that's the end of cycle one. Cycle two, chapters 15 through 21, same pattern is repeated. Job speaks more, his friends speak less. Friends get more and more beaten up. Cycle three, chapter 22 through 27, Job speaks more, friends speak less, they get more and more entrenched. Zophar gives up, doesn't even speak. They have failed to show Job his guilt, haven't changed his mind one bit. That's the end of chapter 27. See, we did it. What thoughts about God do we see in the dialogue section? Well, Job's friends believe God to be high and exalted, blessing those who are righteous while punishing evildoers. This is a very mechanical cause and effect type of thinking about God. I do this, God does this. I do this, God does this. I do this, God does this. It's like two really good chess players. Oh, he made that move, so of course he's going to make that move. You know, back and forth, back and forth. God is far away, he's distant, doesn't really care. He responds to me according to what I do. Job likewise believes God to be high and exalted, but as God afflicts the righteous, God is also arbitrary, absent, and unjust. Job buys the premise, but then accuses God of being unjust. God is not cooperating with the rules of Job's theology. That's the problem. What makes this book so interesting, among other things, is that there is a lot of good theology and good thinking about God all through the book. Everybody says something right about God. But there's also a lot of bad theology here. And at the beginning, when everything was going well, when Job was prosperous, we didn't see any of the bad theology. It took Job's affliction for that theology to come up from the surface, for them to get talking about it and to hear these things about God that are not true. This dialogue section has revealed much that was concealed previously. It's gotten some things into the open. 43 years ago, Johnny Erickson dived into a pool. We all know what happened next. Since that time, for the last several decades, we have all been blessed by the thoughts about God that have come from Johnny's beautiful mind that he has given her. As she spends time in the scriptures and talks about what her affliction has meant to her. I read an article this week about Johnny. She now has cancer. You would think that quadriplegia would be enough for one person in one lifetime. But now on top of that, she has cancer. She's upbeat about it. She says, my theology of suffering hasn't changed one bit. I already have a theology of suffering. But my relationship with God, says Johnny, has grown in the last 6 months. Can you imagine that? The thoughts about God that have come from her mind, we've all been blessed by it. Even if you don't know who she is, you know somebody who knows her or has been blessed by her. Never would have heard those things from her anyway, were it not for her affliction. Affliction reveals our true thoughts about God, be they false or right. We're about done. I have an assignment for us all this week. Over the next week, I'd like for each of us to ask and answer this question. What thoughts about God come to my attention when I am afflicted? And you don't have to be afflicted like Job or injured like Johnny for this to be a meaningful exercise. We all experience disappointments and discomforts that are comparatively minor, but nonetheless, afflictions. Strained relationships, physical weaknesses, financial burdens, challenges to our personal worth. What aspects of God's character do these things make me think about? If I'm in the middle of a strained relationship, do I think about God as a reconciler, as the reconciler? If I'm experiencing physical weakness, do I think about God as the healer? If I experience financial burdens, do I think about God as the provider? If I face a challenge to my personal sense of worth, do I think about God as the one who made me in His image and likeness and who gave me value because of who He is as my Creator? See, we need to learn to begin to make these connections between our afflictions and our thinking about God, just as Job is learning to do. Big idea for today. My thoughts about God will be tested and revealed by affliction. At chapter 27 of the book of Job, there is not much resolution here. But there is resolution in the book of Job. Right? This is not like the sound of one hand clapping. All right, we're going to come to the end of this book and we're going to see the lines come together, mostly. If we're waiting for a resolution to Job's thinking about God here in chapter 27, we're in good company, though. We're thinking about God with Job. Next week, we'll continue to think about God with Job by talking about the purpose of affliction. I hope you'll be with us.